Let me start the recording by asking you, please, to introduce yourself. Say your name and your job title for Brazilian people, please.
I am Lewis Kunkel, professor of pediatrics and genetics at Harvard Medical School and a member of the Division of Genetics at Boston Children's Hospital, Boston, Massachusetts,
Perfect timing.
USA.
Thank you. What is your involvement with the Duchenne disease?
So, my lab was the lab that first described the gene responsible, mutated in Duchenne dystrophy. We described the protein dystrophin, and then described a whole series of proteins associated with dystrophin over the years that they themselves cause forms of limb-girdle muscular dystrophy. And I have collaborated over the years with the ZATS laboratory from way, way back, probably in the early 90s, maybe in 1980s. And people from her lab have come to my lab, and I have sent people for short stays down to her place. So in the last few years, we've been trying to develop therapeutics for Duchenne dystrophy. And I happened to learn from Mayanna and a visiting postdoctoral fellow, Natasha, who had described these dogs that seemed to escape dystrophin deficiency, which was very unusual.
First of all, let's talk about the first collaborations. Was it a fertile collaboration with Mayanna Zatz in the beginning? Because she describes 23 genes, I think, that are associated with muscular dystrophy in several forms.
That's correct. And several of those genes we co-described
Great.
over the years. We've published probably five or six, maybe seven times together in the past in the scientific literature. One of her postdocs wrote a review mostly on the work that she did when she was here in my lab. Maria Zasloff, I believe her name is. And so we've worked together for many years.
Great. Let's start now with the Jagged1 discovery. When was the first time you heard about the escaper's dog?
When I met Natasha and Mayanna at a meeting here in the US, one of the human genetics meetings, and Natasha was interviewing with me for a postdoctoral position. She was just getting her degree. And I interviewed her, and she told me the story about these dogs. And I said, well, that's something we should probably work on up here in Boston when you come up here. This was unprecedented in what we knew about dystrophin deficiency in humans and mice and in other dogs. And we'd always proposed in the past that there might be modifiers, loci in the human genome that encoded some protein that allowed people to not be as severely affected with dystrophin deficiency. We never anticipated one that would live a normal lifespan like the dogs. Well, right now I'm working with a big pharmaceutical company here in Boston, Pfizer, to look for small molecules, drugs, which would increase in a small amount JAG1 so that we could actually test them on both a mouse model to show that it works in mice and then go on and show it potentially in humans that we can have the same effect.
Great. Natasha talked about the zebrafish model you have there, and that
Yes.
she was able to use it to prove. What's the importance of this model?
Well, the zebrafish is very small, and they show an abnormal muscle structure right from birth, almost from birth, at 4 days post-fertilization. You can detect the abnormality of dystrophin-deficient fish. At that age, they're permeable to small molecules. And so you can ask for, do things change the outcome of dystrophin deficiency by putting in their water? Unlike cells in culture, these are live organisms with dystrophin deficiency who have a skeletal muscle defect. So they're very powerful. We've been using them to test for drugs that would ameliorate symptoms.
Yeah, and you have a quick response, right?
Yes, very quick. They're very quick. And you can look at many drugs at a time, at over time. much faster than you can in mice. And so you screen in fish for best candidates, and then you go to mice to show that you also influence dystrophin deficient mice. And ultimately, we would potentially go back to dog, to the severely affected dogs, or into human trials.
In your point of view, how was the discovery made? You think it was it had a good sequence of steps to reach the conclusion?
It went on a logical set of steps with ups and downs all the way, where we got data back that looked very promising, and then but it wasn't sufficient to narrow down which gene it was. And then we got more data back, and that didn't narrow it as well as we wanted. And then finally, we got the final sequencing data back that showed that the JAG1 gene had a sequence variant in it, in the escaper dogs. It didn't exist in the affected or unaffected dogs. And it increased the level of JAG1 by about 2.5-fold in the dog, as well as we showed in zebrafish that JAG1 increasing its levels decreases the number of affected zebrafish with dystrophin deficiency. So very nice story. It was a collaborative story between the Broad Institute, the Brazilian group, and my group. So it was a three-way collaboration.
What did you did exactly? What your group did exactly? What was your role in this research?
Well, Natasha was here, and I mentored her, and we sent the samples to the Broad Institute to be genotyped. She then met with them, came back to me, and we went over the data. And then she went back to the Broad Institute and then sent the data back to Mayanna. So it was a three-way interaction. But Natasha was physically located in my laboratory.
So it's good you have a feedback from all the groups at the same time. Don't have to wait for months to talk to each other. It was a great design.
That was the way it worked, and it's the best way for things to work in science, is a collaborative effort among groups. This just happened to be a very international one. That they tend to be a little more difficult. But then again, as I said, we've worked with Mayanna and her group for many years. And so there's a trust factor there as well.
You said there was some upside downs on the research, that sometimes you could prove something or not.
Science has its ups and downs. So you get really excited about something, but then you realize you don't know everything and that you need to do more work to understand it better. And those are the ups and downs of science. And it's all mostly hard work to get the data that you finally get that says, yes, I found something.
When you found a gene in the chromosome 9 that seems to be promising to explain the escaper phenotype, but it wasn't really the gene that was primarily involved in this phenotype, were you frustrated? How was your feeling at the time?
I was a bit frustrated. Natasha was very frustrated. as the PI of the lab, you know, you console her to do more experiments, to think more carefully about it and come up with additional experiments to answer the question and go forward. We're still working on the other candidate. It's the only one that's expressed exclusively decreased expression in the escaper dogs versus the normal dogs and the affected dogs. And it also could be a target for small molecule therapies. So currently part of our research.
When you reach the jagged one as a possible target for the explanation of this phenotype, are you convinced?
100% certain?
Yeah.
No. I'm 98% certain that it plays a role in disease pathogenesis, but there's always some little bit of doubt that I have that it might not. We've shown in zebrafish that it works and in the dog. We're in the process of now replicating all of this in mice. And once I've replicated in mice, I'll be 100% convinced.
So can we say it's a new perspective to look for a treatment for DMD?
Absolutely. It's a new direction that's independent of dystrophin. And it says that there's something, the dog tells us this, there's something that you can express or a change in the background genetics that allows you to get around the dystrophin deficiency. So they tell us that, and we think we've figured it out, but we still have more to do.
And do you think it's a new hope for people who suffer from DMD, and we can expect something to happen soon or not yet?
I don't want to say soon, but because everything takes longer than one would like. But it's a different direction than being pursued. It's going to be complementary to therapies that are being developed already. You know, there are human trials currently underway in Europe and in the States for exon skipping and stop codon read-through. There's also myostatin upregulation. They're recruiting for that. So there are a lot of therapies that are being developed that would be complemented by yet additional approaches to the therapy. So it's a promising time for kids with Duchenne.
Great. These other therapies you said, they are only looking at dystrophin, the gene dystrophin or the protein, or they are looking for other alternatives as well?
Well, most of the ones in human trials currently look just at dystrophin protein, trying to correct the protein, not getting at the secondary consequences. The only one that's sort of out there that's a little different is the myostatin inhibition, where that allows muscle to bulk up and increase strength. And that's they're recruiting for that now here in the States. How that's going to work, I don't know whether it works.
What's the difference between finding the gene and looking for a therapy?
Well, what we've done is now present to the world a good target to look at. And so everybody out there, other scientists, can now follow up on our observation and go forward with some, maybe thinking about it completely differently than we are. So we've presented it to the world. That's the publication. Now the follow-up, we're looking at, as I said, to trying to find small molecules or compounds, drugs, that would increase JAG expression by two or three-fold to mimic what happens in the dog. And that would be a drug.
And it would be systemic, right? Can you know if there's side effects?
Well, we don't know yet. It would depend on the drug. Those are why we have to do animal studies in mice to actually ask, are there off-target sites? If you increase JAG1 expression in a mouse by a small molecule, do you change it? Because in the dogs, it's being caused by a promoter that's expressed in muscle. Mm-hmm. So you're increasing the expression in skeletal muscle, not in other tissues. Mm. So, but a drug would make a change in other tissues. The gene editing is coming, though. It's a long time in coming because you have to do it at fertilization. And many of the kids that you don't know, the mother and father don't know that they're at risk for Duchenne dystrophy. And so you wouldn't be testing fertilized embryos.
So that's why it's important to have a drug, not only the gene therapy.
That's correct.
Thinking from 1987, when you discovered the dystrophin gene, and this discovery now, do you think it's an important discovery or not?
It's a big discovery, and it opens the field a new direction at getting at genetic modifiers of dystrophin deficiency. And I know others are looking for other modifiers that might be useful because the disease is pretty standard, but there are individuals who are much less severely affected, yet they would be predicted. They don't make any protein, dystrophin, but they're milder than would be predicted. And so they probably have a modifier. One of the things that Natasha and I have talked about is trying to look at JAG1 levels in the less severely affected humans to ask, is it elevated slightly? Those are ongoing experiments. Myanna has a number of patients who are brothers who are discordant for the phenotype. So one is much more severely affected than the other.
Oh, that's great. That's a huge step to see if in humans it can work as well, right?
That's right.
Do you have anything to add to the people that have DMD disease and you think they should wait or have more hope? Do you want to add something?
Well, I'll add is that I consider this the decade of therapy. That therapies are being developed as we speak that will ameliorate and slow the progression of Duchenne dystrophy. And so I'm very optimistic that very positive things will happen in the next 5 years.
Just a last question. For the duration of the work, it was a really long effort. Do you think is it usual to have such a long effort to discover something like this?
Everything takes time in the lab. Sometimes it moves very quickly, and other times it's very slowly. And it depends a lot on how many people are working on it, how well they work together, but it still takes a long time to do things.
In this case, do you think it was a good match with people or not?
It was a great match with people, and Natasha was the one that was the driving force of it. I would say that for sure. She pushed this to make sure it happened.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kunkel. Thank you very much. Thank you for your patience. I'm really glad we had this conversation.
Good. Thank you for talking to me. Good luck down in Brazil.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.